typically entrance by foundry has the field takes on the vent, on the walls of this room, the electric field for this, going outside to make them everywhere inside. Right? And it has to do with what set of conditions is sufficient to guarantee uniqueness of the solution. So you get a whole class of solutions to these things, all these Fourier integrals we've been doing. But now, what's going to pin that down to one precise function? Well, boundary. Boundary values or initial values, depending on it.
Like your initial values, E naught and B naught, if you've got values there, would it be easy to tell this is not a wave?
Maxwell's equation, let's see, what's sufficient? If you give me all of the E and B fields at time t equals 0, so everywhere in space, right, that's sufficient to give a unique solution to the Maxwell equation. Same thing for general relativity. You specify the metric everywhere on a space-like hypersurface, right? So some surface that covers everywhere at somebody's notion of now, where our notions of now might differ, but we'll pick one. That's a space-like hypersurface. Everywhere, the tangent vectors of that surface are space-like vectors. Then that would be a space-like surface, and if it covers everything, then specifying the initial conditions on such a surface is called a Cauchy surface. Technically, it's sufficient to really give a solution everywhere. In curved spaces, it's a little tricky because all general relativity really tells you is, you know, if I give initial data on some section like that, you know, all bets are off outside of, inside here, that can happen, but, you know, a cataclysmic gravitational wave could be coming in from outside of my initial region and I wouldn't know it. So things could drastically change outside of that that path light cone. So you run into things like that, that initial value problems in GR. Wave equations, yes, wave solutions. I suppose something that doesn't have any wave-like solutions wouldn't be a wave equation. You might do it the other way around. If you can get sines and cosines out, or, you know, oscillatory solutions that propagate, that's what you're after with wave equations. And certainly, this has solutions for that property. You can modify this a fair amount to get that. A wave equation in two dimensions is, the second order version of the same thing. It takes some velocity. This describes motion of a string. I can have U of X and T here. That equation describes the, any sort of wave propagating along a string. I think propagation. Propagation and oscillation are the things you're looking for. So you probably have to go complex to get that with first order equations. But second order equations are always going to give you either exponentials or sines and cosines. And so the second order equations, you got a 50-50 shot at it right off the bat. So I hope that clarifies it all.
Sure, thanks.
Other questions? Okay, so I wanted to back up before we pick up where we left off with electromagnetism. I wanted to back up and talk about the Dirac state, which I neglected to mention. Has anybody done the anti-commutator of B&D Dagger for the Dirac equation? Should we do it? I'm curious about it. You're going to do it, though. So, okay, you'll tell us all about it. All right. So, yeah, I I think B-daggers, it's in the book online. You can check it out there. But I think it comes out with a funny sign. And I said all of this. If you compute the commentator of these, or if you use consequently how it works. If you impose commutation relations on the Dirac field and its conjugate momentum, you will find that the commutator of B with B dagger is minus delta, not plus delta. I believe that's what happens. And that will lead to B being the raising operator and B dagger being the lowering operator, so that you would be creating particles out of nothing or annihilating particles and sending nothing out. You know, you'd have non-conservation all over the place.
Why can't we just define B and B dagger the opposite?
It's not the way it happens to the other fields. You know, with the scalar field, we had A and A dagger. You could replace it in the field, but that's not really going to help, right? So you've got phi as this integral, and you've got an A and a B dagger. E to the something. And so your question is, if we had put B here in the first place, but what would happen by the time you look at, you've got ID slash minus M psi bar psi, right? Engage this. So now you add the electromagnetic interaction. This becomes a big D, covariance. So you still have this stuff, but then you're also going to have something like an A slash phi bar psi, as you know, the electromagnetic interaction terms will be there as well. And what it would mean here would be that if you look at the ordering of things that would occur, okay, over here you'd have A plus B sub, and then you have your photon, and over here it would be all A dagger and B dagger stuff. And let's see now, where did that go awry? Remember, this is the antiparticle. Alright, because this is what came from the minus man solution. So this is either a creation or an annihilation of an antiparticle. So what you have stuff like antiparticle, photon, antiparticle, or particle creation, photon, antiparticle annihilation. So what you have is an antiparticle annihilation, so like a positron coming in and being annihilated, then a creation of a particle going out, so you have an electron going out and you create a photon, violates conservation of charge. I think this is the kind of problem we run into if you try to do that. And, you know, we also, of course, found that the charge operator and the energy operator coming out wrong. If we use commutators instead of anti-commutators, the Hamiltonian operator looked like an A dagger A minus B dagger B if we use the other version of normal ordering. While the charge came out plus, we had an energy here times that, and we had a charge A dagger A plus B dagger B. So the total charge would be the sum of the number of particles and antiparticles. No, not right. The energy would be the energy times the difference of the number. You know, this is not to say that you couldn't sort of carefully thread your way through all the things that you have to fix and fix it in some other way. I wouldn't want to claim definitively that there's no other way you could do it, but this works. It hangs together with our interpretations of the number operators and so on. And a lot of people count on it in their daily life. you better find a relatedly that reproduces the results in the same way. This happened too with the quarks, by the way. Some people worry a lot about the one-third charge, the fractional charges that you find with quarks. And so there are other quark models where you manage to do it with integer charges. You can revamp that model, if you carefully redefine things and look at all the possibilities. People don't usually do that. In string theory, you have a similar thing happen where in some sense, the string theory that everyone has pursued for the last 25 years is the maximal string theory. It is possible to get around the restriction to 10 dimensions for the superstring or 26 dimensions for the bosonic string. You can actually come up with other critical dimensions if you add this additional field. I forget what that additional field is called. It's some sort of moat. I can't remember the name. But people ignore that and go with the maximal model. It's nice when the equation points you to the simplest way of doing things, or some sort of maximal principle for doing it the way it's done. But certainly, standard string theory is rich enough to produce a standard model in probably a half a billion ways. So. that may be enough. Ultimately you want to make predictions and get it right. And, looking at these other modes or relabeling your quark charges or something the route to a new, deeper understanding of what's going on? Yeah, probably not. It could be those. It's good to know these things exist, in case you are working at something else and it would work if only, this other theory were that way instead of this, and you say, oh, but wait a minute, it could be, and you introduce the other motion to the string, and suddenly you've got some new route to go. But not simple to sort this out by doing that as well. Other things will crop up to be trouble. So, in order to get things to line up normally in Dirac theory, we use anti-commutators instead of commutators for the field. This has consequences for the statistics of the field. And as soon as I say that, immediately, remember it right there. What did I erase? Oh, let me draw the picture again. We had a heat flux and a photon going out, and an E minus coming out. That's alarming. So the state of state. You want eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, and we can write the Hamiltonian as integral d3 t over 2 pi cubed, then we have an a dagger a plus a b dagger b. That's the normal order Hamiltonian with the usual anti-commutation relation. So it's clear that these are positive definite operators. The usual harmonic oscillator arguments of positive definiteness of the expectation values of the Hamiltonian will hold. So there's going to be a lowest state. you lower the state until you claim that there must be some state which is annihilated by A and B. So that's what you call the vacuum state. And then you build n particle states by acting with as many A's and B's as you like, at as many momenta as you like, maybe n of those, and the, let's call it prime 1 through A dagger 1 prime. So this acting on the vacuum is going to be a state which has P1 prime through P M. So it's got M particles with momenta P1 through PM prime, and it's got N antiparticles with momenta P1 through PM. And so we have states like that, but there's one kind of state we don't have. Suppose I act twice with the same B. So I try to create two Dirac particles with the same momentum. What happens? Well, I can write this as, F the anti-commutator of those two. And the anti-commutator of two daggers is zero. Two B daggers is zero. So I can't put two particles in the same state. Well, that's good. Fermion. Right. We know that's the right answer because there are atoms. There are nuclei, and that structure builds. So the electrons do not all collapse into the ground state. And sodium is different than hydrogen, and we have chemistry. All is a result of this anti-commutation relation by the time you push it to this level. So the statistics, we get Jeremy Dirac statistics instead of Bose-Einstein statistics. And let's see, what do I need to say about that? Good. Is that familiar? Okay, if you have a lot of particles, in materials, this means that the electrons and the atoms are doing something very different. You know, if I've got a lump of aluminum or copper or something, there are a bunch of free electrons in there, and no two could be in the same state. Well, you can have one spin up and one spin down in the same state, but after that, you've got to go to the next energy level. And, okay, so I've got something like a continuum, approximately a continuum of energy levels. Well, and it might be discrete, actually, but I'm continually going up to the next energy level. So what happens is, for the energy levels of the, say, bosonic atoms, the number of particles versus energy in a Bose gas is some sort of like that, a Boltzmann distribution of energy. But for fermions, you get up to two here and build up like that. You get a distribution like that. Now, if there's some temperature, it'll smear that a little bit, you know, probabilistically speaking. But it's still going to be a sharp cutoff there. The temperature of electrons in a block of copper is like 10,000 degrees, and you can hold it in your hand, right? Because the electron temperature reflects pretty much how many electrons are in there. Not thermal content. You can compute heat capacity, knowing the distribution and, you know, the average energies of those electrons. You can compute conductivity and, you know, those sorts of things. And it says, oh, you'll be able to hold this in your hand even though those electrons are at 10,000 degrees in the ordinary distributional sense of the word. Well, that's weird. But you must use these two different kinds of statistics when you're treating these things, even in the macroscopic applications, condensed matter, that kind of thing. You really need to know whether you're dealing with photons or fermions.
What are the fermion statistics?
Fermi-Dirac. And Bose-Einstein for the boson. Okay.
Can you measure that too?
Measure the energy?
The temperature?
Well, I'm going to say yes, but I haven't included quite what you do. Let's see. If you want to you know, if you put this in contact with another metal that has, you know, the Fermi level down here, then you should expect an energy flow, right? Some of these electrons are going to want to go into the other metal. You know, this might be what makes a thermocouple work. You know, but there are physical effects that depend on this. I haven't looked at them lately. It's been a long time since I've taught that math, but this is borne out by many experiments that make use of, you know, what energy state the electrons are in. Not a lot of heat capacity associated with that, but you know, conductivity depends on relative energy levels. You know, when you put disparate metals together, you know, there can be some difference in electrical potential between them that will be a reflection of what the energy levels of the relevant electrons are. That's the most direct sort of thing I can see this. But, you know, more indirect evidence, as I say, heat capacity are very different in the two circumstances. You predict an actual dependence of the heat capacity on the temperature and other thermodynamic properties, and the results are different. And now you heat up your metal and you see what its heat capacity is, and it does agree with this. So the predictions are correct. Check out that next book, because, you know, this is sort of laid out in, you know, some actually acceptable ways
Who is it? Eric? Charlie might be teaching it right now.
The electrons in a metal are Fermi Dirac particles. And I'm sure, you know, it's got them out of their head. They can, you know, tell you right away. Like I haven't looked at this stuff in years. So. You know, I remember you do different calculations for each capacity. So that's been a while. Okay. So, quantizing the electromagnetic field. Right? Shall we just do that? I don't know. You want to see another of these long calculations again?
Is it?
You know, it's going to end up being A dagger A. So the question is, should we do it? You know, should I assign it to the problem? Should we, I don't know. What do you want to see?
Just for the first list, electromagnetic fields?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just have the question about what do we have to pick the gauge?
Well, no. You can do it covariantly, And yeah, actually, that's, and maybe we should go through the covariance quantization. The thing you need at some point is a projection operator, because you've got this. You've got this problem with the momentum, right? There's not a conjugate momentum unless you stick in. Let's see, how is it you do this? I think you need to put a Lagrange multiplier. Yeah. It's the gauge condition. So we can work through this. Does anybody want to continue along the track we were? I mean, I think now we've got the fields down to two. We've got the polarization vectors. It's the same straightforward problem. So exercise, quantize DNM.
Can you break that into some steps so that we can try it?
Yeah. So, what we have, we have a solution. Okay. First off, we've got gauge conditions. So, we pick the gauge. So, that part is done. And then, we found a solution. So, the remaining three components can be written as our momentum integral in the usual way. And the only difference is we have these polarization vectors now. And we need to sum over the two polarization vectors. Could have a linear combination like that. These can be different for different p's. We have A for each p and lambda, e to the minus I p dot x, and then we have, so I think it's epsilon conjugate lambda. What is it? A conjugate. Well, I think that's the expansion we had last. But the expansion we had last time. So the conjugate momentum. So you need to find DM. I'm not sure whether we wrote that down last time or not. It's just some derivative of this. It was, the electric field associated with that, so it's going to be some time derivative of that. So you get a minus sign here and an energy out front. So impose canonical commutation relations. So what we want is A with its momentum dj to be I times h bar is 1 and delta ij on polarization. And from that we get that Ai with pi is going to be a density. We'll still have a Kronecker ij. That'll be a condition on the polarization vectors. And then we have del 3. If this is dependent on p, or what is this? X and y, sorry. X and y. Del 3 of x minus y. So we want to impose this quantization condition on the fields, which now become operators. Then
Home for the mode operators. So you're going to have something like A of P and lambda, right? You know, what's it going to look like? Well, you're going to probably dot some particular polarization into A and do a Fourier integral e to the I q dot x d cube x, you know, something like that ought to be what you certainly invert the Fourier transform. You'll probably have a sum of fine stuff with some constant here. So what has happened in the previous cases is that some linear combination of Fourier transforms of B will let you solve for A. And similarly for A dagger. A dagger will just be the dagger of this expression. Do you remember how this goes? This is just what we did for the scalar field and the Dirac field. Right. If I multiply this by e to the I q dot x, and I integrate over x, then I'm going to get a delta function from these exponentials. Right? So this times e to the I q dot x integrated over x gives me a Dirac delta of 2 minus 2. Then, since I'm integrating on t, I can go ahead and integrate over that delta function, and it frees up these coefficients. Right? So I'll have this vector times that amplitude. I'll also have this, you know, maybe times something probably evaluated at minus q, because I'll get a delta of t plus q here. So I'll have some linear combination of those two mode amplitudes equaling some integral over A. I get a similar thing for pi, and if I take some linear combination of those, I can free up my A. So I dot them with the polarization vector to get rid of these epsilon. And I take whatever linear combination frees up this. So I'm trying to solve for this thing. I can do it by inverse Fourier transform. Okay, then this dagger just takes the dagger of whatever expression you get. The next step is to compute you're going to want the commutator of those.
That is E lambda, the system you need.
This one? Lambda? Yeah, and there will be a couple of these, you know, one for each lambda that's just in there. So then find the Hamiltonian operator. Right. The electromagnetic field doesn't carry any charge, so we don't have charge here. So, and you can expect that H is going to be an integral over momenta. It really ought to come out looking pretty much like what we had before. We'll have a sum over polarization of number operators times the energy of each P integrated over all P. So that should be the answer to the Hamiltonian right there, I think. Not sure what else we would expect to be in there. Probably got it written. Yeah, it's exactly that. You can calculate the pointing vector. Be the
Yeah. I was reading through this yesterday, and he does things in the opposite order. He imposes the canonical, or the commutation relations on A and A dagger, and then goes from there, chapter. And he ends up getting So it's on page 97. He ends up getting a particular relationship between A and the conjugate momentum, which he's referring to as E. You get this other term with the K vectors, the wave vectors. It's equation 4.74.
4.74, yeah.
So instead of getting...
Get the Kronecker.
Instead of getting just the Kronecker, you get this other funny thing.
Right. Let's see, now why is that? Oh, of course.
It has to be a projection operator because of the epsilon. Right. Epsilon I, epsilon j, summed over the polarization state. It has to be Kronecker ij minus ki kj over k squared, because k is orthogonal to these. Right? So you couldn't have Kronecker, just Kronecker here, because k dot, that would be zero, but k dot the Kronecker would just be k. Right? This is a projection orthogonal to k.
Okay.
So this thing acting on an epsilon gives the epsilon, this thing acting on k. So if I have a basis E1, E2, and K, right, that's an orthonormal basis. Not normal, I have to divide by K here. That's an orthonormal basis. And this projects into the E1, E2 subplane.
Okay.
So so we really should have that here, right?
Yeah, that's I guess what my question was.
Right. So yeah, because here we know that del dot A has to be zero. By the time we take the Fourier transform of this, that means that K dot A has to be zero.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what happens in the Fourier transform? This is not so simple to write here. Actually, yeah, that should drop that up. Yeah, you could run into trouble from this. Let's see. So
he just writes it with the integral. He doesn't.
The thing you can certainly do is impose a commutation relation on the mode amplitude, and this projection operator is the sum over the polarization vector. Now, how that translates back, it's an awkward condition to write del dot A equals zero. You know, what does it mean? Well, in the Fourier transform, del dot A equals zero means, okay, I'm going to pull down a momentum here, so I'm going to get PI, EI, and that's going to have to be zero, or P or K, same thing. But, If you wanted an expression in terms of x and y, that's not so pretty. You need something divergent and free over here, so I'm not sure what that would be. You need some differential operator or something acting on this delta function. That wouldn't be pretty. So, yeah. So probably best to assume back here is that this gives your delta 3 of T minus Q. Okay, is there anything else in that one? Or does that define
it?
Two by cubed.
I have another delta, the Kronecker delta.
These depend on lambda prime here. So we get something only if the polarizations are the same, and there's 2 by 2. So you can assume this, and then if you compute, so let's see. What's not to say here? You do want to solve for these. But, work at the
the other way. You want to find the commutator of AI with EJ, the electric field, and these will probably depend on some momentum. On the polarization. So for equal polarizations, we'll get something here. But it cannot be, with these, are we in momentum space here? Or,
maybe we can just work through it. No. You know, it's the Fourier transform of this.
I've forgotten that. Okay, so let me back up. The commutation relation remains complicated in coordinates. All right. The problem is, even though we put on these gauge conditions, we can't just say that the commutator of A with pi is Kronecker or IJ times the delta, because there are too many degrees of freedom. I still runs over 1, 2, 3, but there are only two states, two polarizations. So there's another constraint that has to fold into this before we're really down to the physical degrees of freedom. And that other constraint is the vanishing divergence, which this only satisfies by putting a condition on the polarization vector. So how does that translate back into a condition on these? So here's a sequence of things that happen. Let me just write it over here. Okay, so first we know what we want for the commutation relationship with the raising and lowering operators. So we can just demand that. They commute unless you've got the same polarization and the same momentum, in which case you pick up this delta function contribution like that. Okay, and that's fine, because you don't have too many of those. You know, lambda equals 1 to 2, so you've got just the two mode amplitudes. You've also got Ki epsilon I at any lambda equals 0. We have this condition. And so, let's see. If we then go ahead and work out the commutation relation of I guess this is still the electric field, pi. Pi I is the electric field, it's just a time derivative. And you work that out, the derivative of this thing. But looking at the commutation relationship here, it's going to be a commutator. You can write this in terms of the Fourier transform. And then, okay, the commutator of these expansions. So epsilon I A depending on the A lambda. I got X plus the dagger stuff
And then, okay, the commutator of that with the momentum piece. Now, what was the momentum? Is it just the time derivative?
We had it last time. It was,
Do you see it there? What did we get?
It's there's a negative I omega squared in the beginning.
Omega squared.
That's the end of the energy. From the
energy, but isn't
or is it not squared?
It's probably the same dot, right?
Yeah.
Certainly it is up to its sign. So let's see, here we've got, just P dot X is E T minus K dot X, or omega T with the minus
I. Oh,
so if I take I'm going to pull down a minus I omega, when I compute the time derivative. And then I'll have a relative sign here. So I should have epsilon j of q lambda prime a of q lambda prime e to the minus I p dot x minus epsilon j conjugate e lambda a dash, or sorry, q lambda prime, q lambda prime, e to the I, q dot x. Okay, and then, commutator. Okay, so we know, this time we know how to compute the commutators of the a's, and we'll get what has to happen over here. And what it's going to turn out to be is the Fourier transform of a projection operator built from K. So what happens here is we're going to end up with a Fourier transform D3K 2 pi 2 e to the minus I k dot x of delta I j minus k I k j over k squared. Notice that delta I j minus k I k j, anything in this form, one way to test if something's a projection operator is to square it and see if it comes back to itself. Anything that squares to itself is a projection operator. Delta ij gives me a delta ik here. Then this term I get ki, k is k over k vector squared. Then this term I get minus another one, same thing actually, ki, kk over k squared. And then the last term, I'm going to square this, I have a k squared squared in the denominator, but the kj kj gives me a k squared and cancels one. So I get a third term with the opposite sign, and otherwise the same factor. And a pair of those cancel, and I get the same result. So that's one thing that tells me it's a projection operator. But there's something else that tells me it's a projection operator. I can
okay.
So also notice that if I act with delta I j minus k I k j over k squared, let that act on k. What does it do to k? Well, okay, the Kronecker just gives me a k I. Then here I get k I k j
over K squared, right, that cancels. That's why that K squared is in the denominator, to make that cancel. And what I end up with is KI minus KI is zero. So this matrix acting on K is zero. It projects out that direction. Now what happens if I let this thing act on epsilon? Delta ij minus ki kj over k squared. Acting on either of my allowed epsilon j's, what happens? Well, the delta gives me an epsilon lambda I. Then I have minus ki and kj epsilon j over k squared. What's k dot epsilon?
Zero.
So that goes away, and I just get epsilon. So this projection operator leaves the epsilon alone and annihilates k. And this is a common construction. You know, if you want a direction perpendicular to some given vector, you take the identity minus an outer product of normalized vectors in that direction. The standard construction for a projection operator. Well, if I build a tensor, if I build a tensor out of the epsilon, what is it? So now consider epsilon lambda I, epsilon lambda j, epsilon lambda. Well, what are these things? Suppose epsilon 1 is 100, and epsilon 2 is 010. Now we're talking about a propagation in the k direction, in the z direction. Then what would this be? In that case, the sum on lambda epsilon lambda I epsilon lambda j is the outer product of a pair of these plus the outer product of a pair of those. Well, the outer product of 100, outer product 100 is 100000000. Then I have 010 outer product 010. I just take the product of each of those with each of those, and I get this gives me, okay, 0 for the first row, 010 for the second row, 0 for the third row. And what I get is 110. What is that? That's a projection operator, but diagonal to the z direction. All right. That is precisely delta ij minus ki kj over k squared, where k is a unit vector, or any vector, actually, in the z direction. So, all right. That's a specific example of this, but in fact, it wouldn't have mattered what direction k was. This is still going to give me a projection operator or a diagonal to k. Whatever two independent directions are spanned by these two unit vectors, the sum of outer products of those two is going to span a two-dimensional subspace or a diagonal to k. And that's described by this. So, actually, this outer sum is also a projection operator. Well, how do we know that? Square it. See if it comes back to itself. What happens if we take sum on lambda, epsilon, I lambda, epsilon, lambda, j, and dot that with sum on lambda prime, epsilon, I, or j, lambda prime, epsilon, k, lambda prime, or lambda prime k, like that. That's the sum on lambda and lambda prime. of epsilon I lambda, then I have a dot product, epsilon lambda j with epsilon lambda prime j. What is that? Then epsilon lambda prime k. Well, right, the epsilons are orthogonal unit vectors perpendicular to k. The dot product, if any two of them, is 1 if lambda equals lambda prime and 0 if lambda is not equal to lambda prime. So this is just Kronecker lambda lambda prime. And if I then do the sum on lambda prime, I get epsilon I lambda epsilon k lambda. Because it changes the lambda prime to lambda, sum on the remaining lambda, it squares to itself. So it's a projection operator.
Why did you flip up lambda k?
Lambda.
They're different.
Oh, they're independent and they don't know about each other. That's just, I like to put the k last, but you can write it either way. No, that they live in different spaces. Lambda just runs 1 to 2. It just tells us which vector we're talking about. I, J, K run from 1 to 3. Those are the three, you know, spatial indices of the vector. So lambda is just a label. I just didn't know where to put it.
When Maggiore does this sum, he does 1 half E, I, E, J star plus E, I, star.
Oh, because they're complex.
Minus, yeah, with a minus k, like what's the...
Okay, right, so far so good.
Yeah.
If we've got two real orthogonal vectors, we can just do this. Okay, but now, if you want to allow these fields to be complex, then, you know, the demand is just that, you know, the final A of x is real. So, you know, we're using complex Fourier modes, so we can have complex amplitudes here, and these unit vectors could be complex. yeah, okay, so then the question is, you know, well, what sum do we want? It needs to be real. You know, what is the orthonormality condition of this sum? Let's see. I guess we do sometimes actually take them to be complex if we have a circular or polarized thing, right? All right, so if they're complex, and I want to take an outer product, but I want a real outer product, I better take 1 times the conjugate of the other. So I could take, let me lower an index here, but let's take the conjugate. But now that's not equal to its conjugate, because if I take the conjugate of this, I'm going to get the conjugate of the I one with the J one. So let's write that. So EI lambda conjugate times E lambda J. But now I'm overcounting, so I need a half to sum on both polarizations. And presumably that...
It does some. So in the second term, it's negative K. So you said they're both
negative k? Where's k?
It says that they're functions of k. And...
Oh.
And then...
Yeah, they are. They are.
Which is depends on which...
You're doing a Fourier expansion. C is the same as k. So for each particular wave vector and frequency... Although we had a delta function of frequency. So for each particular wave vector k, you can have a different amplitude and different polarization. So you can have a superposition of a right circularly polarized and left circularly polarized waves at different momentum. You know, different frequency. You've got a, you know, yellow light polarized that way with blue light polarized that way. Different wave vectors to, you know, like different frequencies and different polars, that's fine. No problem doing that. So these amplitudes and polarization vectors depend on k. All right, so now what happens? Let's see. Ultimately, what is the condition? The condition is our gauge condition. The condition is
you know, del dot A has got to be zero. And then, let's see, well, that's something for E, but, what we're going to get, if we took del dot A equals zero, what's it going to give us here? Well, here we're going to pull down a plus I K, so we're going to have K dot epsilon of, you know, lambda and K E to the minus I P dot X, and there's an A in here. But on this term, it's going to pull down a minus I K. So I'll have minus I K dot epsilon A dagger and E to the minus lambda and K as well, E to the I P dot X. Now, all of that has to be zero, but it's still under an integral sign. So, to find out the actual algebraic condition on these guys, you've got to inverse Fourier transform. And inverse Fourier transforming is going to give you, let's see, so if I take, shall I just do this? Let me just. Let me just be clear about it. I'm sort of breaking through, and I'm going to leave half the group here. The other half will fall asleep. I wouldn't blame any of them. Let me just back up and do this right. So, let me erase over here. So, let's impose the gauge condition carefully and find the condition on these samples. Let's just do it. You see what I mean about there being something new with each, you know, higher rank tensor. You know, this is what happens. You know, you think, oh, I know how to do this. Well, no, you don't.
Polarization is funny because you learn about, I mean, even in three terms of graduate E&M,
you know,
I got the polarization and didn't go anywhere with it after that. You know, there's like, okay, there's a vector. And then here it's also confusing because K and the two epsilons make up a coordinate frame, but you call them two different things, so it really is confusing as to, because it's really, you could just write them as three unit vectors, but we write them as K and epsilon because they have physical.
K is the momentum vector, and it really meets the range of all values. So what you need is K vector over its magnitude as one of the unit vectors. You could give that a K dependent name, you know, like an epsilon 3, but you know,
right.
Yeah, third is the lesser of 29 equals 3. I don't know. We have AI. I finally got the right color here. D3T. 2 pi Q. 20 pp. Then we have epsilon of lambda and p. Doesn't matter which order I write those because they don't know about each other. And it is the some particular tree vector. We have the annihilation operator, or well, what will be, that depends on lambda and t. E to the minus I, p dot x, plus epsilon I conjugate, lambda p, a dagger, lambda p, e to the I, p dot x. And if I compute del dot A equals zero, I get some clear thing over here. I'm going to pull down what? Okay, here, e to the minus I px is e to the minus I, then we have e t minus p dot x. So it's going to pull down plus IP. So I'm going to have I, and then P dot, this I means it's some tree, real tree vector, not real, but it's some three-dimensional vector. And then everything else, A, lambda T, minus I, P dot X. On this term,
has the opposite sign, so I'm going to pull down a minus I V dot the conjugate. On conjugate, depending on lambda and D, A dagger, lambda D, E to the I, V dot F. Now, throughout, don't get confused, K is the same as T, right? H bar is 1, T is H bar K for no way. I can use T or K anywhere. So, we've been talking K, but we can just as well use T. So, the inverse Fourier transform multiply by e to the I 2 dot x and integrate over x. So I still have it all equal to 0. I'm going to have d3t, I'm going to have d3x, I have 2 pi cubed root twice et. Then I t dot epsilon of lambda t, a of lambda t, e to the minus I t minus q dot x. There's also minus I d t here. Let's let time t equals 0. This doesn't depend on time, so that would just be 1. Then minus I t dot t conjugate lambda t. And over here, we're going to have the opposite sign, and that's going to bring in the minus t. So we have e to the I t plus q dot x. And we do the x integral. And it's going to turn these into Dirac delta functions. So we'll have I p dot epsilon of lambda p, a of lambda p, delta 3 of t minus q, minus I p dot epsilon conjugate lambda t, a dagger lambda p, delta 3 of t plus q. And now I do the integral over p, and I get at least some algebraic relation between these guys. Let's see, there's an overall I and a 2 pi cubed, and the delta is going to make this twice eq. All the p's will become plus or minus q. Then we have q dot epsilon lambda and p. Unfortunately, we've got this A floating along for the ride. And then these are functions of Q now. Then minus P dot, minus becomes, in this term, P becomes minus Q. So we get a plus here, Q dot epsilon star of minus q, and then an a dagger of lambda minus q. So all of that has to be 0. Well, these out front are just constants. We can get rid of that. So we have some condition, at least, on these things, but it's convoluted of these a's. Now, the vanishing of this, nonetheless, the a's are not 0. So, certainly the simplest thing we could do is ask for those two dot products to be 0. But what it means is then that q dot epsilon star of minus q should vanish. Was that the condition that you saw in the text?
Yeah, I mean, it just ended up having this, that when we did the sum with the half and the front, the first term was of q and the second term was of minus q.
Yeah.
It seems like it's coming from here, but I'm not.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, The A and the A dagger are independent. We haven't done anything else. The only thing that could make this thing be zero are these dot products. I don't see any way we can cancel the one term against the other because these A's are, you know, even classically, they're in some independent functions. One's a complex conjugate of the other, so they're not equal. So we've got to take those. Those two dot products to vanish. So let's see what that does for us. So we conclude that now let me change the piece here. First, K dot epsilon of lambda and K equals zero, and K dot epsilon star of lambda and minus K equals zero. Whatever that means. Let's see. So how can we sort this out? All right, let's just consider.
That'd be Q dot
epsilon. Let's look at the sum on lambda of epsilon of lambda and some particular K with epsilon some lambda, same lambda, same K. Let me write these. So lambda and k is going to have too many indices floating around. Lambda and k conjugate, but now we want minus k here. So just consider that somewhere. Well, that's not real. So let's consider the real part of that, the real part of that product. So we'll take epsilon I conjugate. Let's see. Is this k or minus k here?
So what he has is the first term is both plus k, and the second term is both minus k.
The conjugate term.
The two epsilons are both plus k, and then
both plus k here, both minus here.
Yeah.
We can do that. Really, that's the right thing to do.
I don't know.
All right, let's see what happens. All right, so obviously there are various things we can consider here. We could consider various combinations. Well, you know, we want an epsilon and epsilon star, so we need a symmetric between the I and J in complex conjugation. Right, this is some operator Pij, right? It depends on k and minus k. Let's just define it. Okay, first off, let's look at the conjugate of that thing and see if it's, say, real or anything like that. So we're going to get epsilon I conjugate at lambda and k. Epsilon J of lambda and K. I don't know, doesn't look very real, does it? Sure. Okay, that's equal to Pij at minus K. Right, so this thing is some function of K. And if I take the conjugate, I don't get exactly the same thing. I get the same thing at minus k. Right, well, if it's possible that p of k is equal to p of minus k. In fact, we'll see that's the case. So in fact, it will be real. Let's look at what happens if we... Okay, let's see if it's a projection operator.
Hello.
Hey, Ken.
Can I come in?
Oh, yeah. Please do. We're talking about projection operators and electromagnetic fields and stuff.
Oh.
Hope you don't mind hanging with us for a little while. Got your papers?
No, actually. Sorry. I couldn't find it. This morning. Everywhere.
Well, we can talk about tensors then.
Okay.
So, it is not manifestly real, but I'm almost ready to claim that it's real nonetheless. Notice that it has the property, CIJ, if I contract it with K, what am I going to get? Alright, we have these two relationships. So, epsilon star minus K is annihilated by K, and epsilon of K is annihilated by K. What are we going to get here? Ah, this isn't bad, because suppose I replace K by minus K. This implies that minus K dot epsilon of lambda and minus K is equal to zero. So, cancel the minus sign. So, and similarly, this implies that K dot epsilon of star of lambda and K is equal to zero. So, just replacing K by minus K in these two orthogonality conditions shows us that it doesn't matter whether there's a plus or a minus K in there, K is still going to kill any of these epsilons. So then it becomes clear, if I put a KJ on here, this epsilon J of plus or minus K with K is zero, epsilon J conjugate dot K is zero. Epsilon J dot K is zero. Doesn't matter whether the argument is plus K or minus K.
Can you use those relations to prove that epsilon of K and epsilon of minus K are equal to each other? Because they both equal zero. So you can pull out the...
No, only dotted with K.
But can't you... So you put both of them on both sides and then you say dot the difference between them with...
No. Let epsilon, here's a counterexample. Let epsilon be I hat, you know, 1 over root 2, because we want to normalize it, plus complex unit I times J hat. Then let K be something in the Z direction. Right, that's orthogonal to both this and its conjugate, but this is not equal to its conjugate.
Okay.
And this is exactly the, you know, circular.
Oh, no, it's not the conjugate. It's just if you switch K to minus K, and there's no K.
No K in there.
Yeah.
So it's not necessary.
No, but it is. And
wait, what? Oh.
So if in your epsilon I switch K to minus K, since it's not K dependent, then it is equal to, if you write epsilon as a function of K, but there's no K dependence, then if I switch K to minus K, it doesn't matter. It's not a function of it, so they are equal to.
Wait, what are you claiming are equal?
I'm claiming that epsilon of lambda comma K and epsilon of lambda comma minus K are equal to each other. No star.
Okay, so we need some K dependence, right?
So
okay.
I'm saying in your first line, you take the minus sign off the right equation, you set both of those two things equal to each other, because they're both equal to zero, and then you say, well, it's actually the difference of K dot epsilon of lambda comma K and epsilon.
Alright, how about epsilon is e to the I K dot sum x naught times I hat. It's not equal to its conjugate.
Okay.
So you can have a
fraction
on there.
Okay.
So I think we can't get enough out.
Okay. Sorry.
No. Try things. Catch things. That's great. But I I think that's a counterexample. This does annihilate, this operator does annihilate anything in the k direction. And the thing we'd like to be able to claim is that, in fact, it is uniquely that projection operator orthogonal to k. So, let's see, let's check that it is a projection operator. We can do that by squaring it. So you get a quarter over this infinity, sum on lambda prime. Then, how distinct can I be here? If I can copy the argument, let's see. I've got epsilon I, epsilon star j, who, these are lambda k guys. Let me keep the lambda k. No. Plus epsilon I conjugate lambda minus k epsilon j lambda minus k times I have epsilon j of lambda prime k epsilon k star of lambda prime k plus epsilon j conjugate lambda prime minus k and epsilon k, and that's lambda prime and minus k. No one will ever read that, except there's a wonderful zoom on those things online. So maybe you'll see that that's actually, it looks a little like a moose. Infer what it is. You'll get it. Let's see what we know about these things. So, the first term, we're going to have an epsilon I lambda k, and then the dot product of an epsilon j star of lambda and k with epsilon j of lambda prime and thing k. That thing there, that dot product. And then an epsilon star k lambda prime k. That's the first term. Okay. We're going to have to think about what's orthogonal and what's not. But then we have this one with the last one. That dot product is two epsilon stars. So epsilon I and the k, then epsilon star j lambda k with epsilon star j of lambda prime and minus k, and then epsilon, here it is, this thing, that's a k, no, that's a, what is that? Oh, that is a k, yeah, wrong, that's the other k, too many k's, of lambda prime and minus. Carefully drawn. Just so you know. And two more things. Then the second term.
That's a photon.
Yeah, right. You admitted a photon.
That's why we're speaking.
Finally, epsilon I star lambda and minus k times epsilon j of lambda and minus k dotted with epsilon j star of lambda prime and minus k and epsilon j of lambda prime and minus k. Okay, so all of that. And now, hopefully, half of those are zero.
What's going to be?
I'll be back. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Please just don't have one going over my head.
Okay. I'll keep a tight leash on it.
Right. Okay.
You
may say to touch my stuff, so.
Now,
sadly, I've got to escape.
Oh, okay.
I'll catch her from the flood.
So, you know, this is supposed to turn out to be that delta plus KK over K magnitude thing.
Okay.
It probably does. We may have to sort out which of these dot products is zero. You know, we've got, let's see, so, yeah, all right, sure, see ya. If we have the same lambda and K, then, all right, so that first inner product, this thing here, we've got two different lambdas, but we've got the same K, we've got an epsilon with an epsilon star. Now, that ought to be one. If lambda equals lambda prime, and zero if lambda is not equal to lambda prime. So, you know, for complex vectors, the inner product really ought to be b dot b star. Right? That should be the normal inner product. So if we want orthogonal complex vectors, we should take b dot b star equals zero. Or equals one if it's normalized. So this thing ought to be delta lambda lambda prime. So we'll get one if the two lambdas are the same and zero otherwise. Now let's see, there's probably another one like that. That last one. They're both evaluated as minus k. So here that ought to be also delta of lambda and lambda prime. But now we have to figure out what those other ones are.
It seems like epsilon is dependent on K. Intuitively, it seems to me that the K dependence of epsilon is not a functional dependence, but a directional dependence. So if K is pointed this way, then the two epsilons are like this.
Yeah.
But if K is pointed like this, then the two epsilons have to be somewhere in this plane. Is that? Because if that's true,
then it's independent of the sign of K. Right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if it's the opposite sign, then if they're orthogonal, then they should be orthogonal.
Maybe that really is the... Oh, let's see. So they lie in the same plane, but that phase example is troubling because it's not the same complex unit vector.
Yeah. But if something is orthogonal in with K positive, then it should be orthogonal.
Yeah, that's what we got in the box up here.
Yeah.
So yes, that's true. So they still stay in the same plane. But if I take, so suppose we have that epsilon up there as, say, epsilon of 1.
Uh-huh.
So this one with a phase. So, you know, suppose that's epsilon 1, epsilon 2 is, you know, e the I, you know, perhaps some other phase entirely, y naught j. Right? Those are orthogonal by... each of these dotted with its complex conjugate is 1. But if I dot this with the conjugate of that, or this with that, or this with that at minus k, you know, it's, well, actually that's still 0. But let's see, if I dot this with the same thing, what's different? So, I wonder if that's always true. If that's possible. But they stay orthogonal, but have funny phases.
But if I take epsilon 1 dot epsilon 1, like here, without taking any conjugates, I pick up some funny face.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that thing, okay, fine. And it's not going to matter whether I've got k or minus k or something. You know, I'm going to get some funny face. Fine. One. Maybe... Oh, all right. This one plus that one, the sum of these two might be real. Because I've got a minus k. Now, the minus k exists. That's not so good. All right. So, if I take the, if I can check the trace of this thing, what's the trace? If I set I equal to J in sum, that's the normal dot product there, so I get delta lambda lambda. That's the normal dot product there, that will be at its minus K. So that's the magnitude of the conjugate, which doesn't have to be, or no, that's the magnitude of the thing at minus K. But it's still a unit vector. So that would be 1 for each lambda. So I sum over lambda, I've got 2, and the sum over 2 lambdas gives me 4 over 2. So the trace of P is 2. So it's projecting to a two-dimensional subspace if we can resist the projection. Yuck. Let's see. How can we... what do we expect to get down here? You know, these funny dot products in the middle, these two, you know, it's clear that changing k to minus k, I still have, if the lambdas are the same, changing k to minus k to change the phase, that thing is probably not always zero. For different lambdas it might be. Let's see if we can prove it was zero.
But the results in your lambda loop.
Yeah.
Let's see how they're different. So
what if we have at some particular place, I should be able to write epsilon 1 vector as some function of k, complex function of k, and let's suppose we're in the xy plane. So these could be any two complex functions, alpha squared plus beta squared. Let's impose the condition. So this thing dotted into its conjugate, it needs to be 1, and that's going to be alpha star plus beta star. So that's got to be 1. Then there's an epsilon 2 that is, I'd say, mu of k, I hat, same subspace, maybe some different functions here, j. And so we're going to have mu star plus mu star has to be 1 as well, because they're both unit vectors. They're also orthogonal, so if I take epsilon 1 conjugate with epsilon 2, that better be 0. And its conjugate, it better be 0. So what is that dot product? That's alpha mu star plus beta mu star equals 0. And the conjugate equation holds as well. So let's see, what is that? 4 equations, we can fix some of these things. Then, if we change k to minus k,
okay.
I'm not sure I can make these things phases.
see. I could solve for, what could I solve for? Say, okay, I also have the conjugate of this alpha star mu plus beta star mu equals 0. So I can write mu as minus alpha star over beta star. Yeah, got an idea? What? Oh, okay. So I can eliminate mu. Then mu conjugate is just the conjugate of that. That's probably all I can say. So there's mu. So let's see. Then I have mu star plus mu star. So this thing times this conjugate is going to be alpha star over beta star mu, then a mu star, and an alpha over beta. That all ought to be 1. So mu star, 1 plus alpha star over beta star ought to be 1. What is this? This is mu star over beta star times alpha, beta star plus alpha star is 1. So that's got to be 1. So mu star equals beta star. They only get the five. Okay, there's something. Let's see. Okay, mu beta star is an alpha star mu. Let's see, if I take that times its conjugate, what am I going to get? So mu star, beta star, beta, that better be alpha star, mu star. But beta equals mu, so I have the same relationship for alpha and alpha star equals mu star. Okay, so far so good. Let's see, am I going to get anything else? What's mu star? Does that tell me anything? No, that's just canceling. I get the same thing. So I could write these things as some real numbers and some phases. Real parts, cosines and sines would be nicely.
Is it important now, looking at what you have in the box over here, the fact that since alpha is beta, let me see, oh, it's not there, it's then times the conjugate, never mind.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is write these things as an amplitude. Yeah, what if I wrote alpha is r e to the I phi, beta is s e to the I theta? Then I need alpha star plus beta star is 1. That says r squared plus s squared equals 1. So I could let this be e to the I phi times the cosine of something, and this be e to the I theta times the sine of the same thing, whatever a is. And then these tell me, well, let's see, so nu is going to have some amplitude and some phase, but it's got to be equal to, okay, the ratio of the amplitude of these guys, or wait, let's see, nu star, so that's got to be cos squared a is nu star. So this has to be plus or minus cosine of a times a. And then here, what do we get?
which is also equal to minus alpha star over beta star, that's a cotangent of A, times the phase difference here, conjugate phase difference, e to the I theta minus phi, times mu. And what's mu? Mu has the same magnitude as theta, so mu's got a sine A here, and then it's got its own phase, e to the I delta. So this is cos over sine, so this becomes minus cosine of A e to the I delta plus theta minus sine. So there's mu in terms of the other one. Mu is going to be, what did you say, minus cosine of A e to the I delta plus theta minus sine. And then mu's got to be a sine A kind of thing. I guess it could have been a plus or minus sine A, couldn't it? But then it's got a phase anyway, so we should take it to be plus, just by fixing delta the right way. So mu is going to be a sine of A times u to the I delta. Okay. Do we know anything else? So that's getting there. Now, if we were to take here's one problem. This A, we have sine and cosine of A. That A can depend on K. And A of minus K doesn't have to be related in any particular way to A of plus K. So, what do we get? Some indifference formulas, maybe? I don't know. Seems to be more degrees of freedom than we really need to grab a photon.
Yeah.
Let's see. The same with the thing conjugate. We got to go one?
Yeah.
Now, that's okay. We're just putting this out. I mean, it's just some two-dimensional vectors, right? It's just, how hard can it be, really? But it's hard to see what has to be the case. If I take a dot product between two conjugate or two real ones there, so the third line down on our last equation, we've got the dot product with E. What is it? Is that E of minus K with E of K?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we don't have a whole lot of information there.
We can. Yeah.
We could impose something. See ya. Have a good break. Okay, so is there anything that tells us about orthogonality between, suppose we take E1 of K and dot it with dot it with E2 of minus K.
So you can figure out the relations, because we can, phases don't matter, the cosines and sines, we know whether they're even or odd.
Well, we've got some relations. I don't see that we have enough relations. We've complexified these vectors, but what do we know about them? Right? They're unit vectors. They're two dimensional. Let's see. They've got to span the plane. their conjugates still span the plane. Evaluating them at minus k still spans the plane. So, you know, it certainly has to be the case, for example, that E1 of minus k is some linear combination of E1 of k and E2 of k.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can write things like that. Everything can be expanded in terms of those guys. But do I know whether this is orthogonal to E2? Not obvious. What happens if I take it here? I've got E1 dot E2 of minus k. So that's going to give me alpha of k times mu of minus k plus or conjugate something. Oh, these aren't conjugate even. Beta of k, mu of minus k. I don't think I know anything about the relationships of those. I don't know how these functions are related to mu and nu. I'm not getting the conjugate. I don't know if there's enough information here to lock these things in. I mean, surely there's some standard way of doing that. I mean, Jackson probably knows. Oh, do this. That's the answer. But we know something more than that. You know, like the overall phase or something.
In the phase, those four equations you have, if they're in the phase, be dependent on K or just